From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2015 when New York State announced a new Commissioner of Education. Back in 2014, then-Commissioner John King left New York State, taking a job with the Federal Department of Education. His successor has now crossed the three-year mark, Mary Ellen Elia, a former teacher herself. Elia began her teaching career in 1970, working as a social studies teacher in Buffalo's Sweet Home Central School District. She taught for 19 years before moving into administrative roles. This hour, it's a chance to discuss education from a range of angles. We'll talk standardized tests, teacher evaluations, teacher-government relations, and more. Commissioner Elia, hello. Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Well, it's great to be here. I appreciate being in Rochester and seeing some of the incredible institutions that are supporting this community.
I think our listeners may not know that you grew up not too far from here.
I was actually born in Irondequoit.
Oh, born in Irondequoit. See, there's something not even I know. Okay.
That's it.
And then went to or spent most of your formative years where?
In Lewiston, upstate New York, outside of Niagara Falls. And then for college, I went to Damon College and then University of Buffalo and then Buffalo State.
Maybe that's one of the reasons that you've been putting so many miles on. You're used to the travel that upstaters have to do.
Well, I remember when I was teaching and everybody used to think that other parts of the state got more attention than the upstate area. And I used to think, geez, we're really important, too. And so this gives me a great opportunity to get around the state. Plus, I needed to talk to a lot of people and find out what was on their mind.
Last night we were at an event and someone said, oh, you've been doing this for the commissioner job for 2 years. And you quickly said, three years.
3 years.
You've put some miles in. I wonder if you could at least start for us by outlining how you viewed the role of the job to begin with. I mean, there's nothing more complex, I think, in policymaking than trying to, quote unquote, solve education or improve education, particularly for districts that are struggling. How did you come into this role, especially knowing that we have some districts here that are really, really struggling, Rochester perhaps more than any other?
Well, I think understanding the differences that exist and what are some of the factors that bring those differences. But I think when I came back to New York after 30 years of being in Florida, I came back and things were really at a high pitch. And we needed to figure out what those factors were that had caused everyone stress. And then address them. So that's what I did. But first of all, I had to really take the opportunity to get out and listen to people and talk to people. So the stakeholders, if you will, around the state, the people who actually are in teaching classrooms and in administrative positions, as whether it's principals or superintendents, they really were living different scenarios. And some of the things that had been changed in the state and at a very quick pace had caused a lot of stress. And so it was important to hear from people and figure out what we needed to do as a plan to move forward in New York.
And as you mentioned, coming from Florida, you were superintendent of Hillsborough County for about 10 years, is that
yes,
right?
Yes.
And for our listeners, that's Tampa, essentially.
Yeah, it's Florida's different in the fact that there in the whole state there's only 67 districts, and they're all on county lines. And so our district was over 1,000 square miles, very large, had rural areas, suburban areas, and then the inner city and the core areas of urban Tampa.
You had a level of success there that convinced New York State that you were the person for the job to run New York State. And so for 10 years in Hillsborough County, as you say, it's not perfectly apples to apples, but I think around the country, especially when you look at urban versus suburban challenges, I don't say verse, not pitting one against the other, but I think you take the point. What did you do there that was successful in at least raising some of the standards and some of the outcomes in places like Tampa, in places that were the most impoverished parts of Hillsborough?
Well, I think one of the things that that we all need to recognize is the importance of teachers in this whole equation. Teachers are really the people that make the difference every day for kids in their classrooms. And I did a lot to support teachers and provide training for teachers and really think about what were the things in each separate school. So we had schools that were heavily migrant populations of students. And then we had inner city schools where they were not migrant. They had no experience of being outside of the very center part of the city. And those schools had different experiences and different needs. I think part of it is how do you connect the school to the families and the communities? And what can you do on a daily basis to support students? And we looked at ways that we could create after-school programming for students who didn't have somebody to go home to. And we worked very hard to also bring in our partners who were the not-for-profits in the community. So the Boys and Girls Clubs and the YMCA and places that traditionally students and families were in programs. And we wanted to make sure that there was a continuation of great programming and support in those places.
Having worked in top jobs in Florida and New York now, and having, in the capacity of those jobs, traveled around the country to meet with colleagues at different times and places, we, as an aside, we really are a segregated country, aren't we?
Well, we certainly...
Sort of self-sorted that way.
Right. And I will say, New York is probably at the high end of that segregation.
That is... that's a point that not a few people have made, particularly for those who... try to push back against, I think, idealistic liberalism, who say, they point out, you know, look, it's not just southern United States that's pretty well segregated, that the Northeast has some of the most segregated school districts, and not just, again, on racial lines, but on poverty and you know, sort of the haves and have-nots of wealth. And that creates special challenges for you here now. But last night you heard John Lodestri, who we know well with WXXI, and making an impassioned plea that we have to at least declare some kind of failure and start fresh with new ideas. Do you agree with John on that?
Well, I think what we have to do is assess what's happening. And so we have, we've placed in a, last week, I appointed a independent receiver to come in, a distinguished educator to come into Rochester. It's a person that has had a lot of experience, Dr. Jaime Aquino. And he will be doing an assessment of what's happening in the Rochester City Schools and where there are areas that really need to have some adjustments and some changes and that we need to do things differently.
That has to be approved by the Rochester School Board, is that correct?
Yes. The commissioner has, under regulation and law, the ability to establish a distinguished educator in a school, a school district. And then the local district, under the guidance of state ed, has to do a contract with this person. That's where we are right now, and they're in the process of negotiating the terms of that contract.
So I think this is a community that has seen different debates, especially in the last 10 years, about how to kind of cut through the often well-intended, but a lot of the programmatic efforts that don't seem to go anywhere and get somebody to be in charge. So Mayor Warren floated the idea of not full mayoral control, but a sort of a version of mayoral control among the most struggling school districts, I think is probably a fair term to use. And we've seen previous mayors talk about full mayoral control of the school districts. Where do you stand on an issue like mayoral control?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is assess exactly what's going on and where the problems are in the Rochester City School District and what some of the challenges that the school board and administration have faced. And then what are we going to do about it? I can't really speak to what was in place before, but I have been involved in Rochester since I came to be commissioner in New York State. And I will say we haven't moved the mark, and we need to do some different things. And that's why we've placed someone in to give us that overview at the state level so we can help Rochester to improve.
Are you dissatisfied with what you've seen in the last 3 years in Rochester?
Well, we haven't made moves. And as you've seen, if you're watching some of the indicators, it's not all test scores, I can tell you that.
Sure.
But we have other areas that are seriously in need of some change, and we've got to figure out what we can do to support them.
What did you make of the mayor's idea to at least, and again, I don't know that mayoral control is a fair term for what she floated. It wasn't full control of a school district, but the notion of the most struggling schools being given some control to the city administration. What did you make of that?
Well, I don't know anything about it. I wasn't here at the time that that was floated. And so...
You were just coming in, I think.
Well, possibly, but I would say the first 6 months, I was just trying... I was traveling a lot, as
yeah.
I said.
Okay.
And just trying to figure out what needed to be done.
Okay. If she called you now, or I should ask, how often do you have conversations with her? Or is that not as relevant because we don't have mayoral control here? Who are you in touch with most in Rochester about schools?
Well, I intersect a lot with the superintendent and with the school board. However, I do think it's important for the entire community to be part of the work that we're doing here. When we made the decision to put a distinguished educator in Rochester, I personally called Mayor Warren, talked to her. We called the local legislators so that they were aware of the actions and what we were expecting would come out of this.
Talking to the superintendent, well, the commissioner is the official title, New York State Commissioner of Education. It's Mary Ellen Elia, who is visiting Rochester. And as we go throughout this conversation, we'll talk a little bit more about what she is doing here and what brought her to Rochester. Of course, this is not her first trip, and she's traveled quite a bit in her 3 years as commissioner. But we'll get into sort of the arts and cultural side of the visit coming up here. I just want to kind of make sure that we understand exactly what's happening with Jaime Aquino and why you appointed Jaime. So give us a sense for why you chose Jaime Aquino for this role in Rochester.
Well, I think Dr. Aquino brings some experiences and that are very like what Rochester is facing. He has worked in as a teacher. He was an ELL, an English Language Learner teacher in New York City. He also worked in some urban centers in the Northeast. And then he has experience in Los Angeles. And I think if you're going to say to someone, go in and look in and tell us what's going on in a specific district, they have to have a context within which to place the experiences and the things they're seeing. And so he has that. We feel like he'll be a good match for Rochester. And we're waiting for the school board as they move forward in the process. We anticipate mid-August, hopefully, that the contract would be in place.
Okay. And again, this is going to take some time, as you say, to get a full assessment. And if Dr. Aquino gets the thumbs up here and starts work late summer, it's not going to be overnight for changes. I certainly understand that. And we can't sit here today in July and predict what he is going to come and tell you, this is what I think needs to happen.
Right.
But how much control or authority would you give him? If he gets this approval, would you say, look, we're going to give you a lot of room here to make some decisions on what happens here?
Well, he doesn't make the decisions.
Okay.
And he doesn't take over the job of the superintendent. He's
not going to supersede the superintendent. Okay.
No, he's not. He will attend school board meetings. He will be in a position to be in closed session with the school board on discussions. And he will work closely with the superintendent, and he'll also assess. I mean, I think that's the important role that we see, that the distinguished educator can come in and tell us, listen, you know, things have been suggested in Rochester from a report 8 years ago, 6 years ago, and when I go in to assess where we are, I'm making some of the changes that were suggested that either has or hasn't been done. I think those are the kinds of things that we need to have somebody here giving who's really looking at that and doesn't have another job in the school district and isn't part of the school board, but is here to look at exactly what the historical context is and what's happening now that is a reflection of either following guidelines or whatever or not.
What if you get a phone call from a Barbara Dean Williams or a Van White or someone with the school board saying, look, Dr. Aquino's appointment just muddies the water here because we are already doing those things. We are assessing. We are taking stock of the big picture. We are trying every day and every week, and we are here. And this appointment just sort of gets in the way of what we think is the incremental progress we're trying to make.
Let me say this. I believe that the school board chair, White, as well as the superintendent, want to see a quicker pace of improvement. They want to see things getting better in Rochester. And if this is an opportunity, I don't think, in fact, I know they aren't pushing back that they don't want someone to come in and give them and give me the opportunity to know exactly with eyes that aren't part of this system. so they can look at it in a much more kind of separate way.
I also note that when you were in Florida, you say that you offered a lot of support for teachers, which at first glance, the public might say, well, that's obvious. I mean, teachers, of course, teachers deserve the support. Who is out there saying less support for teachers? But it wasn't that long ago. I mean, probably 4 years ago, maybe a year before you came here, when I would say the state of teacher relations, broadly speaking, and certainly the unions, with the state leadership and government, Governor Cuomo, was at its lowest point. And we've seen the rhetoric tamp down a little. You have anything to do with that? Did you come in and did you tell the governor, look, it's been a little hot around here. We got to tamp down that rhetoric. I mean, teachers are not the enemy, because teachers would often tell me we feel like the enemy right now.
Well, I can understand why they did. And I certainly heard that as I traveled across the state. And I heard the areas that are really critically important to teachers. And I understand that. I was a teacher for 17 years. And teachers do great work every day for the kids of this country. And I think it's absolutely critical that we make sure that we don't put them under more stress and we try to support them in any way possible. We're going to be working very closely to listen to teachers and collaboratively develop a model for a teacher evaluation. And I think that that is going to be something that is critically important to our teachers and one of the things that cause them the most stress. And we need to make that a productive process for teachers that they believe will support them as they get better. You know, everybody, you've been in your job. You get better every time you do it.
I hope.
And if you don't, then somebody needs to help you to get better. And I think that's really where we have to be.
Do you blame the governor for some of the heat that teachers were feeling? And was the governor at fault for some of that?
Well, I wasn't here, so let me say that.
That's a dodge.
No, it's really not a dodge. I wasn't here. And if you think about what happened across the country, there was a wave of
sure.
different types of evaluations that were put in states all over the country. And the frustration that you face and your conversations with me right now about Rochester City schools are conversations that I think all legislators and all political leaders have to face, because if kids aren't doing well, what are we going to do about it? So I'm not saying that anybody, you know, was or was not. What I can tell you is we're working really, really strongly now to support teachers across the state. Everything I've seen, that's the reality with the governor. And we need to make sure that we support a quality evaluation process that helps teachers to get better every day. The very best teachers can always get better. The very best commissioners can always get better. And the people that sit with radio stations and interview people can always get better. So that's my goal.
Nobody disagrees with that. Absolutely. And I understand you got to split a bit of a difference here, because as the commissioner, the state commissioner of education, you know, you're maintaining a lot of different relationships. And sometimes what the governor would say is, look, when I'm directing my fire at teachers, I'm not aiming at teachers individually or the teachers in your child's classroom that you're envisioning. He's talking about, at the time, some union leadership, some tensions there. Do teachers' unions get something wrong here? Have you worked with them privately to say, look, this is where I think you might be overstepping? Are they overstepping anywhere?
I don't know, overstepping. They represent teachers.
Sure.
I mean, they should be the ones out there that are voicing the opinions that come from their membership. So that's their role and that's their job. That's an important thing for them. I think that as the commissioner, I understand that the tensions that sometimes exist between some government agencies and some positions and the teachers themselves and the unions. I am not in the political realm, right? And so I am not an appointed person. I'm actually appointed by the regents, and the regents are appointed ultimately by the legislature. But I think it's important to know that politics and children just don't go together. And the further that we can keep the political decision-making on what's happening with teachers in the realm of educators and support people who really want kids and teachers to have the things they need to be successful, I think the better off we are.
When it comes to those evaluations, I'm going to choose Pittsford and Rochester to sort of contrast districts, because a lot of people will raise the point that, you know, it's a 10-12 minute drive between one of the poorest performing districts in New York State and one of the top performing districts in New York State. And so if you had a teacher from Pittsford and a teacher from Rochester in the room together and they were talking about evaluations, and the teacher from Rochester said, look, if you use the same standards to evaluate me that you will use to evaluate this teacher from Pittsford. Is that fair? Are we too reliant on test scores? Can we make sure that we are evaluating in a way that tries to understand all the different context that comes from district to district to district? So let's kind of go through the evaluation process here. Number one, are test scores too prominent, and will they be too prominent?
Oh, I think they are too prominent now. I mean, it's 50% of the APPR plan is test scores. I think that's way over line.
Okay. What's an appropriate number for that?
I don't know. I'm going out now and listening to teachers about what they think should be included in their evaluation process. And I think we need to be listening very carefully and balancing everything.
Some teachers and some parents have said 0% for test scores. What do you say to that?
I'm sure there's others that don't agree with that.
There are plenty who don't.
Okay, and so I think we need to balance, as I said. But I haven't heard, because I haven't been out asking yet, and when I'm doing that in focus groups around the state, impromptu meetings with teachers, working with the union, and whoever else wants to work to support a quality evaluation that supports teachers and doesn't slice them up.
Well, how'd you do it in Florida? I mean, I'm curious to know if there's a model, whether it's in Florida, where you were for 10 years as a superintendent of Hillsborough, or anywhere else. Do you like other models that you see?
Well, and let me say this. One of the highlights of my career in Florida was developing a teacher evaluation system. And one of the things that was key to that was that we did it with the union. And so teachers were at the page. We used a particular rubric. And if teachers didn't like things that were on the rubric, they voted on it. And whatever the vote was, that's what we did.
So how was it done? What was the final kind of model for evaluation?
First of all, there were mentor teachers for the teachers who were new teachers to the field. That was probably the key part of our evaluation system, because these were teachers who taught the same subject that they were supporting teachers to teach. And they were released from their classes, and they had on a ratio of like 1 to 20, 1 to 22 teachers that they worked with all the time. So any new teachers had a experienced teacher at the end of a phone call. They could call them. They could say, this was a terrible lesson. It went terrible. This was a great one, and cry with them and say, how wonderful. Thank you for your help. I mean, so it was really support oriented. And we saw some incredible feedback on that that said that, in fact, those teachers became highly qualified teachers in a much shorter period of time than the normal course of that occurring. So anybody that walks into a classroom, and, you know, I use seventh grade as an example. Anytime you walk in and you're a new teacher, that's not like an easy job. Anybody that thinks that being a teacher is an easy thing, they ought to try it one day. And then they'd realize how wonderful teachers are, and the fact that they move kids and they can support students all the time, and they make a huge difference in their lives. So if you were a teacher going in as a brand new teacher into a seventh grade classroom, you had somebody who was kind of walking that path with you, and it was
one-to-one?
One to like 25.
Okay.
But they didn't have another class. So they weren't teaching their own class. They were doing this mentoring program.
Yeah, forgive me. But so if you're a new teacher, the mentor you had, it wasn't one-to-one. That mentor had other mentees.
Mentees, right.
Okay, I got it. Okay. But yeah. but you had someone you could go to.
And you had contact with them when you needed it, when you wanted it, and they were there in your classroom observing and giving you feedback and helping you.
Okay, so you saw great feedback with that.
Oh, yeah.
What was the expense of a program like that?
Very expensive.
It was. Mm-hmm. Is that why it's not happening here yet?
Well, I mean, there are ways that we could make some of that occur. It wouldn't be the exact same model, but that's okay. I think it's important for us to have the local districts making decisions about what they think will be very supportive. I was in a very, very large district, over 200,000 students. And in fact, we hired between 900 and 1,200, 1,300 teachers a year. So you had a lot of brand new teachers in all these 270 buildings. You had a lot of places that teachers were brand new and they needed support. But we have here, we have regulation that has schools providing for all new teachers a mentor, if you will, someone who can talk to them and work with them at that school. That happens in a variable way across the state. Maybe that's one of the things we need to look at really strengthening.
What about the other parts of the model of evaluation for teachers where you were in Florida? How much did test scores come into play?
The test scores came in at 40%, mm-hmm. which I think actually is too high. I think that was too high for us, but the state was actually moving to a different percentage that was higher, like New York did. And we were able to make some variations on that because we had been working so long on that product, on that whole evaluation system. But I will say one of the things that was part of our system also was that there were more observations. And I think that more constant feedback. But listen, what I developed in Florida was a unique situation in a unique district where the union and the management was extremely close in terms of developing these things. So when you come back to a state like New York, you have over 700 school districts. Each of them is negotiating their own systems. And if we're going to come up with something that can be meaningful, we have to have it meaningful in a way that can be used productively in all those 700 school districts. And so there's got to be some guidelines in it, but we've got to move towards what we want ultimately is the very best teacher that we can have in every one of the classrooms in New York State, helping every one of our students to be successful.
Do you agree with the idea that if you had the exact same approach and test scores were 50% as they were now in Rochester and Pittsford, that would be unfair? Is that unfair?
I don't think 50% is a good number.
Okay.
I think one of the things we have to do is I have to talk to people across the state, the practitioners across the state. So that is the teachers, the administrators, their principals, all the people that are supporting teachers and what's happening in their classrooms. I think those people have to weigh in on what they think is right. And then we've got to put together a model that takes into account all of the different input that we've had and moves us forward in this way.
I was with a group of people last night, and there was a lot of conversation about sort of the ongoing discussion on poverty's impact on education and this idea that if you fix poverty, you fix education, that you can reform schools all you want, but if poverty is still as persistent as it is, particularly in a place like Rochester, you're going to move the needle very little, and good luck if you don't really fix poverty. And I want to kind of take a temperature with you to see how philosophically aligned with that level of thinking you are, that we can, that we must address. I think everybody says we have to address poverty. I doubt you're going to say we don't. But do you generally agree with those who say, look, fix poverty and you will fix the schools?
No, I don't think that is a magic bullet. Honestly, there's no magic bullet here. Right? Because you could have a district where poverty was really not an issue, but you would not have students getting everything that they should be getting because of other reasons. Could be a lot of other reasons, but it might not be anything related to poverty in that particular district. So I would suggest to you that it's on all fronts. One of the things that I think the Governor Cuomo has worked really hard on and put in place, in fact, is the concept of community schools, which in a way is really doing the kinds of things that we're talking about and overcoming some of the negative factors that poverty puts on our kids by providing additional resources in the school as a community so that we really tap into those community supports that are in place or that we can put in place to support kids. So it's a before school program that has caring adults there. It's a program that then kids receive what they do now, which is the universal breakfast model. And then they're in classroom with teachers that are trained to work with those children who have problems. And some of it's related to poverty and some of it is related to their life. And that can happen anywhere. And then you have an after-school program where children have lots of different activities that they can partake in and that they have support in. And parents don't have to worry about their kids going home to an empty house because they're working to support their family and they can't be home all the time. And that's particularly true of our middle school kids. The governor's also put in additional funding for middle school programming after school. I think all of those things are factors in it. We've got to make sure everything is working together to support kids. And that's got to be the driving force of decisions that are made in school districts.
Let me pose the thought experiment that came up in this conversation with a group of folks, which is that if you took the kids who went to school in Pittsford and for the next year you sent them to Rochester schools, and you took an equivalent number of Rochester students and you sent them to Pittsford schools, you would see the Rochester students struggling in the same roughly the same way, even if they went to the Pittsford schools, and you would see the Pittsford students succeeding in roughly the same way that they do currently in the Pittsford schools, even if you swapped the location of where they went to school these days. Agree or disagree with that?
Well, I think that that's just a sweeping statement that really doesn't get at some of the real issues here. So let me say this. I don't know Pittsford as well.
Sure. However,
any suburban program that has a high success rate has a high success rate given the circumstances around the students that they're working with. So if you had students that were not in that profile of Pittsford or a suburban school district, and you had those students attending classes with the teachers in those suburban areas, it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't need training to be able to work successfully with the students from another environment that require a different approach or maybe require different skill sets. So all of these things are factors that have to be taken into account. I don't think you can say that it is only poverty. But I also don't think you can say, well, if we took care of poverty, everything would be okay everywhere. That's not the case.
I think at a very baseline level for me, if we never changed the economic fundamentals in our region, if they were exactly as they are now, you could never see RCSD getting to the same level of graduation rates, current test scores, et cetera, as a Brighton or a Pittsford, not with the economic factors. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I think it would be a difficult scenario, but let me say this. Pittsford is a much smaller school district, okay, than Rochester. And so if you take a smaller school district has less challenges just by size. Okay, they have teachers that stay for a longer period of time, I would surmise. If that's the case, then you have a different circumstance there. So to make sweeping comments about fix this and it's all over, we're all done, it's just not the way it is.
All right, before we get into arts and culture briefly here, on the subject of testing, which you think has been too highly weighted for evaluations, for parents in recent years who've decided to quote-unquote opt out the students from taking the tests, does that bother you? How do you feel about the opt-out movement?
Well, since I've come to New York, I mean, I've talked to people and talked to parents across the state who have opted their kids out. I think that there are a number of reasons, not the least of which is the stresses that were part of the education system in New York. So teachers were feeling put upon, and that's saying it mildly. And I think that parents reflected on that and said, I don't want my teacher's evaluation to be based on test scores, and therefore this is one of the actions I can take. We've done a lot to, I think, balance back and roll back some things that caused some of those stresses. We had a very long process put in place to adopt new standards. It included stakeholders from across the state. Parents were part of teams. Teachers were part of teams. We adopted new standards. And that was, I think, one particular area that was really needed. We had, and this is not unique to New York, we had in New York adopted standards at a very fast pace. We had put in place a new assessment system, and we had also put in place a new evaluation, all in the matter of less than a year.
when it comes to those parents who are opting students out, you're certainly putting some of that decision-making on protecting teachers. But some parents are doing it because they don't want their children to face the stress of standardized testing, which they say has become too prominent in their kids' minds, setting the teachers aside. Do you understand that, or do you tell parents, look, life is going to be hard, and some parents will tell you, my kids are going to take the test. You know, there's going to be stress. You have to be able to deal with that. How do you feel about it?
So I will tell you, I think that the stresses that have been placed on teachers and in particularly in their classrooms on narrowing the curriculum and not putting in those things that teachers feel are really a critical part of learning, I think that is something that we have to shift. That occurred when, under No Child Left Behind, there was a major focus on English language arts and on mathematics to the detriment of other subjects and other areas. And I think that balance has got to come back into education. Our classrooms have to not be places where kids feel like all I do is get ready for a test. That's insane. We don't need to do that, and we shouldn't be telling children that. And if any kind of evaluation is put teachers in a position where that's kind of what they're doing in a school, we got to reassess that big time. And the leaders of our school districts and the leaders of our schools need to be the ones that are in there voicing that opinion to teachers so that there is not the incredible imbalance. We've got to take care of this evaluation system. And I think that'll be an important part of balancing off what is a good education. We're here to talk about the arts, and in many schools, we know that arts education is just not valued. It's not part of a curriculum, and that is a real loss for kids. We've got to make sure that gets fixed.
More with State Education Commissioner Mary Ellen Elia next on Connections. We're going to ask for her opinion on the Federal Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, and we'll talk about challenges of retaining teachers in struggling districts. Coming up in our second hour, live reaction from our panel filled with leaders in education here in Western New York. We've got the longtime leader of the Rochester Teachers Association, Adam Urbanski. Christopher Albrecht is the New York State Teacher of the Year, and Van White, president of the Rochester City School Board. Do they agree with what they're hearing from the Commissioner of Education this hour? We discuss it with them live next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's continue the discussion this hour with New York State Education Commissioner Mary Ellen Elia. When you've been in Rochester, you've been hearing from people. I think T. Andrew Brown said it pretty well, that when you've got a bunch of like-minded people in the room together, there's a ton of energy. And everyone in these rooms you've been in have been saying, we've got to protect arts education. We cannot just allow tough circumstances to say, well, the first thing you cut is the music, or you cut this arts program, or that's not as important as, you know, it's ELA, it's math, science, that's it. And everyone is sort of rah-rah about that. But the reality for some districts that are really tight is they feel like the system is set up to force them into some of those decisions. I mean, if I'm in a district that's got a really tight budget and I've got a most voters aren't going to vote to go beyond a tax cap. They're not going to give you a supermajority. So they may say, look, Commissioner, I don't have a choice. What do you want me to do here? So we can talk really well when we got all the power players in the room together. But the reality for districts is tough. What do you say to that?
Well, listen, it is tough. Okay, but you've got to make the decisions, and those, and anybody who's on a school board, anybody who is a leader in a district and gets a salary for doing the things that they're doing to support a positive educational environment that is a well-rounded environment, we've got to look at everything we're doing. Yes, it's going to be tough, and maybe it's not to the extent that you'd like to put in an arts program. But we've got to make sure that there are strong connections in the classroom to the arts general curriculums. And then we've got to also make sure, and that's one of the reasons that I'm here, is that the institutions in the communities, these arts and cultural institutions, are great partners with schools and districts to do that. And I think that in and of itself can take some of the pressure off of the cost of things.
And then you have parents, and we hear all the time from parents when we talk higher ed, when we talk the cost of a college education. We have parents who will call and write to the program and say, I have to think about return on investment for my children now, maybe more so than when we were going to school. Because if we're going to be paying X for a college education, I have to figure out, is there a return on this? If you have a debt load that comes out of school that you can't manage for, you know, you can't wipe out for a generation, what are we doing here? And when it comes to the arts, is there a value that comes with that? So I know sometimes to some folks it seems crass to put dollars and cents on arts and cultural education, but I hear from parents all the time who say, look, the money and the jobs are going to be in tech, math, science, and if you got to cut art, you got to cut art, because my kids have got to be able to find a living in the future that's getting tougher and tougher to do that. So what's the message for them?
Well, I don't think there's any question. If you look at, there's a body of research that talks about the importance of creativity in the future workers in America and across the world for the 21st century. We are behind, I'll tell you that. We need to make sure that our kids have those kinds of creative ways to solve problems, to think about things, to think things through differently and not always be doing it exactly the same as other students might be doing it. And those are the things that will make a difference for a student when they leave high school, go into college and get into a job, or they leave high school, they go directly into the job market after a training program. All of those things are part of some of the skills that have come with the 21st century work environment and workplace. And arts is one of the places where kids learn those things. They become creative. They can think differently. They see things in a way that they personally see it, and maybe nobody else does. And so I think those are some of the skills that we need to have in our workforce in the 21st century. And we need to make sure that our kids can be ready for that.
During your visit to Rochester, who and what did you see that really connects arts and culture to schools in a way that you think should be not only maintained but strengthened?
Well, WXXI, that is an incredible resource. Is that the right answer for you?
Well, look, we're not looking for a Homer answer, but
okay,
that's fine.
And then I talked to people at your zoo, and I mean, I think they're doing some great work. Clearly, Eastman is a great resource. I think they're looking for ways that they can expand their connections into the community. And so all of these, you know, I'm going to the library. We're very, very involved with the library systems across the state at State Ed, and we're pushing the reading program for 20 for this year. We've had over 2 million kids last year participate in in library programs across the state, and we're expanding that. And our libraries are just filled with kids of all grade levels and adults doing programs that they don't then have to face a summer slide because they're still reading. They're doing things they like.
We got a few minutes left with New York State's Commissioner of Education, Mary Ellen Elia, who has spent some time in Rochester, spending time across the state, having conversations about arts, culture, the connection to education, and ways to preserve and maintain and strengthen those connections. And so a few other subjects that we haven't hit yet. Play the teacher now. Give me a grade for the performance of Betsy DeVos so far.
Well, I think, you know, Betsy DeVos is not an educator. And I think that says a lot. She is not familiar with public schools, and I think that that comes out in her involvement across the state and across the country. And so I think somebody in that position, I think an educator, someone who has experience and involvement in educational settings, I think would probably serve well to have great connections between what happens in classrooms every day.
So am I hearing an I for incomplete for her?
I don't give grades like that,
okay,
right?
Okay. Well, but on the subject of Betsy DeVos, her supporters would say everything you just said is a feature. She is not an educator. She has not been mired in some of the battles that get political in education. And in many cases, you'll hear her supporters say she's there to change education in ways that are maybe radical, but it's time for a shakeup.
Well, in fact, I think she has been involved in the politics of education, but not in more traditional sense, but rather in other types of educational institutions, some for-profit, some not-for-profit. And I think, I mean, that certainly has to be part of it. So to say she's not been political, I don't think is really online.
Okay. And as you bring up for-profit, I think of Betsy DeVos and the money that her family has invested. There's a lot of conversations about how money is power. Is there any model of for-profit education at any level that you've seen that works?
I'm really not focused on for-profit education. I mean, I think there probably are some great opportunities that we see in for-profit companies that are supporting educators. I just don't have any of them.
Do we speak too broadly about good or bad when we talk charter schools?
Listen, charter schools in New York State and around the country are public schools, right? Our kids go to those schools. We need to make sure everybody's doing a good job educating our children. If parents choose to go into a charter school, that is a public school. Now, I would say to you that there has to be an even playing field, and there, in many cases, is not necessarily. But charter schools are a choice that parents have.
Is there a concern when parents choose that charter school that the non-charters public schools are further strapped by those choices?
I think that is the case.
Do you think that's happening here in Rochester and the charters we have here?
I can't speak specifically to Rochester, but when you look in New York State, there are a number of districts that when students leave the district and go into another type of school, could be a charter, could be a non-public, could be anything, right? Or when they leave the community and they move to another state, then that district has to absorb the fact that there's one less or there's multiple students who are no longer in those classrooms, but yet how do they pare back? And those are some of the tough decisions districts have to make.
When it comes to teachers, we hear about a teacher shortage these days. And yet when I talk to superintendents, and I just think in the last couple of years, you know, Mark Linton in East Rochester, Kevin McGowan in Brighton, every time there's a job opening, they get 200 or 300 digital resumes for a job. And yet I hear about a teacher shortage. Is there a teacher shortage right now?
Well, there is a teacher shortage in Rochester City Schools. And there is a teacher shortage in Buffalo and in other places.
Is that because of turnover?
Some of it is turnover.
Okay.
Some of it also is that when you look at the pipeline for teachers, there are fewer people going into the pipeline to be a teacher. And part of that is because of the stresses that are around teaching. And a student who leaves high school, he has for several years felt and heard teachers and parents talk about the stresses for teachers. Why is he going to go into that occupation? I mean, why is he going to choose that as his field? And so there's lots of choices for kids. I don't think they necessarily are choosing teaching. We need to change that dynamic. I think teaching is, you know, one of the best jobs that you can do as an occupation and a professional. You do good things for people and you feel good and you help them become better. So I think that's a really important thing. But the reality is, if you go to a very rural setting, we have teacher shortages. If you go to an urban setting, we have teacher shortages. Maybe we don't in Brighton.
Okay, fair enough. And when it comes to those shortages in a district like Rochester, if there's more turnover, and I think it's fair just to conclude based on year to year, there's more turnover in urban districts. Why have we failed to convince teachers to stay at the same levels that they do in a Brighton or a Pittsford? And what can you do or what can we do to change that turnover rate?
Well, I think the setting that they're in is a big deal. We've talked about the issues that their students come to school and have stresses in their life, and Rochester is a high poverty rate. And so students who come, it is a setting that dedicated people are in. And if they had opportunities, they may think, you know, I've worked here for a while. I need to move on. And so those are some of the stresses that, in fact, really do affect what happens in classrooms. Because as quality teachers who are experienced move out and they're getting brand new teachers are going to have, they need more support. And they also are going to have less experience.
And when it comes to bringing in teachers of color, we've been coming up on 2 years since we did about a year-long investigation, and even those of us who report on these issues for years were surprised at how little the numbers were in terms of teachers of color. 4 districts in Monroe County out of 19 had 0 African-American teachers, K-12. 4 more had 1. I mean, that lack of representation is really stark, really strong, and powerful. And we know not just the platitudes, but the reality of why that does matter. So we don't have to talk about that. I just want to ask you, are you seeing anything that is happening to change that?
Well, New York actually has a number of programs, TOC programs, Teacher Opportunity Corps, and those programs actually are targeted for minority students going into the teaching field to support them so that they can stay in teaching and that they get the support after they get out. And those are important. Let me say this. This is a national problem. This is not something we have in Rochester or in New York even. This is a national problem. We all need to be worried about that. The teachers that are teaching our students need to look like them and or support them. And it's not like everybody has to in the school feel like every position needs to be given to a minority candidate. That's not the idea. The whole idea is there has to be a balance. And right now, that balance is just in many places doesn't exist.
All right. And I'm going to conclude with a question that I stole from the wisest intellectual pool of resources we have, which is Twitter. So there's this ongoing thread where people are asked, you know, tell us what job you do. And what does the public most often get wrong about the job that you do? Which I thought was fascinating. There's some really interesting stuff there. So you're the Commissioner of Education for New York State. Everyone, I think, the good news is when it comes to schools and education, we all have the same goals for our kids, for our schools. We want kids to be well-educated, well-prepared for the future. People have different ideas on how to get there. But the job to lead this effort can be tough. So what do people most often get wrong about your job?
I think they think that I can fix things overnight. And as I pointed out to a group last night, I don't have a vote. Okay, I'm not a legislator. I don't have votes there in New York. I'm not the governor. I don't have votes, certainly in the governor's, from the governor's perspective. And I can't influence necessarily what's happening in Washington. Now, I can influence, let me say that. I don't have the actual direct vote. And people say, if I tell you something, Commissioner, I want it changed. That just can't happen. I work with other systems, and they all have leaders like school board members or superintendents or principals. And I am kind of the judge, if you will. People put in, they petition us to make decisions on problems that they think occur. And we do that from a perspective of the law. But I can't be the great fixer. What I can do is develop the kinds of models that I can have. I can present to our regents, 17 people that rule the regulations related to education in the state. And hopefully they will move on those recommendations to be able to improve what happens in New York State.
I don't even want to know what your email inbox looks like. The numbers must be staggering. But I just want to say that you've always been accessible to us and our reporters here. We appreciate that. We know it's not an easy job. Thanks for coming in, for taking the time. And I know we'll see you again in Rochester soon.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Coming up in our next hour, you're going to hear a reaction to this conversation from people in the educational field, prominent roles right here in Western New York. Van White, president of the Rochester City School Board, joins us. Chris Albrecht, New York State Teacher of the Year, is here. And Adam Urbanski, longtime head of the Rochester Teachers Association. That's next.